On this week's episode of The Freenoter, we look at the role of the audience and how much you should customize your freenotes.
We'll examine the work of Sally Hogshead, who tailors every talk to her audience.
And we ring in the holidays with our take on a classic, the champagne cocktail.
Cheers. We're having one now. All this and more on this week's episode of The Freenoter. So this week, we're going to take a look at one of the most important aspects of any freenoter and any freenote. In fact,
what is it, Tom?
It might be the most important aspect because it's why we're there. It's the audience.
That's why we're there?
That's why we're there.
That's true.
I know. That's not why our bosses and our employers think we're there.
But they are necessary to accomplish the thing that we're doing the freenote for. So ultimately, yes. And I think that's the case a lot of people can make back to their offices.
It is. And an audience is the thing that stops a speech from just being crazy talk.
You mean you wouldn't normally just stand up on stage and talk out loud?
I would.
And talk out loud.
I'm a big fan of crazy talk, and I like to do crazy talk whenever I can. But sometimes there are people there, and that's how I make my living.
Well, often there are people there, and that's the entire point of a freenote.
It is indeed. So here's a question for you.
I can't take you seriously with your hair like that.
I know. I just... For those of you who aren't seeing the video version of this, and there is no video version of this, I just flopped my hair back into like a flock of seagulls. It was a disaster.
Did you run?
So far away.
Couldn't get away.
Could not get away.
Is that flock of seagulls?
It is.
Okay, good.
It is flock of seagulls. Yeah. Thanks for playing. Do you customize your talks for every gig that you do? It sounds like a lot of work.
I do a little. I mean, so there's a couple different ways I think you can think about customizing. I mean, one is you actually do a different talk for every conference. And we mentioned it only in passing on a previous episode, but that way lies absolute exhaustion on the part of a freenoter. I am not a fan of that. I think I am a fan of coming up with kind of what is your talk or your topic for that year and then figuring out how to frame it in such a way that it's a good fit for various conferences. So that's the first thing I do is that I'll frame it differently. And then the second thing I do very much has to do with my speaking style, which is I'm going to take into account who I'm talking to and on the fly often will be incorporating some of those things in addition to some of the work that I've done in advance.
How much research do you think we should do about the audience? And I'm sure if you read some best practices book on giving a talk that you should do all this research on who the audience is, what company they are. I mean, there's only so much you can do, right? There's no sort of direct way to get that kind of information necessarily.
Well, there is direct way. I mean, one is your own experience at the particular organization where you work. I mean, you are ideally already working with the kind of people you want to work with more. So that is an extraordinarily valuable group of people to be able to talk to. So I say if you're going to do research on a new topic, you know, or a new talk, then one of the first places to start is with your own customer base and things like what were they looking for? What problems, how do they frame the problems that you solve? What are the big ahas they had as a result of working with you? Because those can be really key moments in a talk that you're giving to another group of people. So I really do believe that you can do that. The second thing that you can do if you don't have that already, and this is something I try to do when I'm working with, if I have an opportunity to talk with the meeting planners and the meeting organizers in advance, is see if I can either pull some of that information from them, because they know their audience really well, or a technique I know several of our friends and colleagues do is that they ask if they can speak with certain people in the audience. Will the organizer make available certain members of the audience so that you can have that kind of opportunity to research? But you are the researcher. So what kind of research do you think would be appropriate, accurate, fair enough to do before kind of shaping a talk around an audience?
Well, one of the things that a freenoter, and we've talked about this in a previous show, a freenoter is often writing a speaking proposal, right? And so they have already sort of outlined, this is the thing that I would like to talk about and the takeaways, and this is my angle. So I think it's fair game if you're a freenoter, if that proposal is accepted, that is the thing that you go and do.
It should be the thing that you go and do.
That stands on its own.
Yeah, it's not fair for you to bait and switch like that.
Absolutely not. So at that point, I'm not necessarily customizing to an audience. I've already written a thing to the audience I think they have, and I'm going to develop that talk, right?
Well, you've written the description to the audience. And of course, there's a big difference between writing the description and writing the talk. And that's definitely stuff for us to get into more in future episodes. But when I'm writing a talk, generally, there are a couple places where I do consciously flip it and massage it a bit for the audience. I find with how I structure my keynotes, the kind of the core center bit of the talk pretty much stays the same. I mean, for me, that is the revelation of kind of the real problem that I feel like that I'm solving for them. The real problem they have to solve before they'll solve the problem they think they have. Kind of the big truth of the, of that. Why is that problem so important? And the third thing that doesn't often change is what's the high level shift in thinking or behavior. Those things stay steady for me. Audience to audience to audience. The things that will change from one audience to another is how I get into that. In other words, I will change depending on who I'm talking to, the way that I frame what I call the goal, which is what question the audience is asking right now. And I'll use whatever that frame is to get into that middle piece. And then the other place where I tend to customize is at the back end with the actions, because depending on where that audience is, kind of back to a previous episode when we're talking about, are they in the red zone? Are they like really, really close to wanting to act? Are they further away? They're going to need a different level of information to actually be able to start to put that, that high level shift in thinking or behavior into play. But I mean, what are some of the things that you do?
Well, in general, there are two opportunities in my talks for customization. And one of them is the opening of the talk. And the opening of the talk for me is always custom.
Yeah. And you often do it right on the fly.
And it's very much on the fly. Yeah.
I envy that.
Well, it's just reps, I think. It's just reps. But I always try to work
in. You're also a witty guy. I mean, your customization is often like an on the fly, actually good joke. I mean, not like, hey, I just flew in and my hands are tired.
I will give you an example of a thing, of an opening. Because the second thing that I do actually does require more work. But I do try and customize an opening, even if it's nothing more than a joke. I once gave a talk at the corporate meeting for Frito-Lay's digital team. And I subtitled it, Pushing Through the Dip. I actually did that.
I'm pretty sure you may be the only person who could get away with that, but
yeah,
bravo. So, cheers bravo. To
Thank
that.
Thank you. Yeah, cheers sir. To that. Clink. Yes, Clink. My Frito-Lay corporate talk was subtitled Pushing Through the Dip. I will often try to take into account whatever else has been going on at that conference that day, prior speakers, themes that I'm seeing emerge, and I'll work that into an opening. And that's on the fly. That's absolutely something I do on the fly. But in my main talks, and in a given year, I might have four or five talks that I give, which is probably more than most paid keynoters might have, who put all of their effort into one killer keynote. I don't have that luxury. I often have to talk on different topics.
Yeah, I've got two and I have a third in development.
But in those main talks, I have the structure of those talks does not change. The flow of those talks does not change. But the examples that I use will change. The examples that I use to stick to that structure, I'm not reinventing the talk, will change depending on whether I'm talking to marketers, if I'm talking to agencies, if I'm talking to technology people. And I will talk to all three in the course of a year. And so there'll be B2C examples, there'll be B2B examples, but also the types of historical references and things that I'll make. And I just have a menu of those things. Yeah. And those I will customize.
And I'm definitely, there are a couple camps on this too, about how much you try to pretend like you are of the industry that you're speaking to. I am definitely of the camp that says, don't try to do that. Because unless you have actually worked in the industry that you're talking to, I think there's so much danger in trying to be like, hey, here's this data I found. And with my luck, I would pick like the one source that everybody thinks is like the worst possible source for that. So I pretty much stay to my lane. I will customize if it's an industry that I spent a long time in. So, just last week I was speaking to public radio stations and I spent 15 years in nonprofit. So I am going to talk about donor relations and donor retention and how communications can affect that because I can actually speak about that. But I will admit there was a time where I spoke earlier this year to the wholesale fruit and vegetable Association. I forget what it's named. And even then, I didn't try to pretend like I knew where they were coming from. And so the way that I customized that one was to speak from the perspective of a consumer. And because, again, that's the only way that I could feel like I could customize in a way that was true and authentic, and I wouldn't, and it had integrity, and I wouldn't be misstepping in some horrible, horrible way.
Is that the weirdest talk you've ever given in terms of distance from where your orbits normally rotate?
In as far as, you know, have I ever worked with or for a wholesale fruit or vegetable distributor? No. And yet it actually, the talk that I was giving worked extraordinarily well for them, because it was a talk where I talk a lot about my journey with weight loss and my role as a Weight Watchers leader. And so I definitely could tap into, you know, 20 years now of deep appreciation for fruits and vegetables and the evolution in that amount of time that I've seen, not only in how they're packaged and distributed, but also how the general public has responded to them. And so I could speak from that.
Shout out to fruits and vegetables.
Shout out to fruits and vegetables. Yeah. I met somebody from the Andy Boy lettuce company.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Andy Boy.
Andy's real. Like, Andy's the founder of the company. And like, that's,
is he still a boy?
He's not still a boy.
Oh
no. But it was actually, I mean, it was a cool conference. Like,
Foxy?
I didn't meet the Foxy people.
Yeah.
I could spot them from a mile away, though.
They're probably like, they're probably like sharks and jets, right? The Andy Boy people and the Foxy people. You know, a jet. This fall on Netflix, Lettuce Wars.
A who?
Lettuce Wars.
Oh, Lettuce Wars.
Lettuce Wars.
I thought you said Alanis Morris.
Starring in Lettuce Wars. The weirdest talk I ever gave in terms of, you know, the cognitive dissonance of, why am I speaking to these people? It actually made some sense from a business perspective. But I gave a keynote at the Gilbarco Veeder-Root Customer and Partner Conference. And if you don't know who Gilbarco Veeder-Root are,
Gesundheit.
Thank you. They are makers of gas pump technology.
Oh, the talking gas pump people.
The talking gas pump people. Yeah. If you've ever, you know, pulled into a, you know, a Pilot or a Flying J and had your gas pump talk to you about the news.
Because I do long haul trucking a lot.
Well, in another life you did, I think. But I rescued you. I took you away from all that. I spoke at their conference, and I will say it made a business sense, because we actually do research on how many people see the ads on those gas pumps, but they wanted me to keynote their conference. And again, as I typically do, I customized two things. Number one, I customized my on-ramp into the talk, and I had, you know, because they partner with convenience stores a lot, I had a whole bit that I sort of half did on the fly and half wrote about the little rotating hot dog griller things that you see in every, you know, convenience store. But the part that I spent some time on was rotating out an example that I often use for one that talks about Buc-ee's, which is a big Texas-based gas station and convenience store. And if you don't know, if you're not familiar with Buc-ee's is famous for their bathrooms. And they put up billboards all across the interstate on Texas saying, you can hold it. There's a Buc-ee's.
Interstates on Texas?
Interstates on Texas.
Okay.
Yes. Or I guess they would just be called states. Intrastates. I don't know. But they advertise how clean their bathrooms are. And if you've ever been to a Buc-ee's, you could eat off the floor. I wouldn't.
Are you giving your keynote right now?
Maybe. But it was relevant to the audience, so I did. So I used that. But yes, thank you. I'll stop now. It was weird for me to talk to gas pump people.
It was weird for you to talk to gas pump people. So what did you do to connect what you do to what they do?
Well, it's very easy for me to connect what I do to what they do, honestly, because I talk to, we have a huge out-of-home research business with our exit polling, and there's no other way to measure how many people saw the advertisements on a gas pump or watch the TV that's playing on a gas pump other than what we do, which is send exit pollsters out with clipboards and observe it and watch it. So that's why I was asked there to begin with. But it was this whole ecosystem that I never speak to in the course of a year.
Yeah.
And it was fun to customize that talk.
Yeah. I mean, I love what you're saying there, because I think it reflects something that we were often taught back in my days as being a Weight Watcher leader while I was moonlighting from being a brand and message strategist as part of my full-time job, that we were always told that we were an expert in the program and in the plan of Weight Watchers, but that our members were experts in themselves. And that's something that I carry forward into my free noting and T&E noting and keynoting now, which is I know what I am talking about. I have a breadth of knowledge across different industries about message strategy, about change communications. But I really try hard not to lose the perspective that the people that I'm talking to are experts in their own companies. And I think that one of the ways to make sure that you kind of keep that balance right with a free note is not overstepping those bounds and saying, well, I know what you're going through better than you do. No, you don't. You really don't. And so your job as a freenoter is to figure out, okay, what can I do in the course of this talk that I'm giving to this audience? I really see it comes down to really three questions that an audience has to answer. And one is this thing that you're telling me about possible? Period. Like, is it possible for it to happen in the world? Do I agree? Have you made the case that whatever you're talking about is valid and possible? The second thing, and I think this is really important from a free noting perspective, is it possible for me? Meaning, I see what you're doing there. I see how what value this research that you're talking about, Tom, could have to a company. But if I think I am a company that couldn't possibly afford it, then I need to hear from you as an audience member that it's actually possible for me, that there's some way either that you do this at a price point that I can accommodate, or that you're giving me information that tells me that I can do it by developing that stuff in-house. And then the third piece that I think is really important for an audience to hear, and I think this is, again, this is one of those places where you can customize, is it worth it for me? If I believe it's possible, and I believe it's possible for me or at my company, is it worth it for me to do that? And how have you, as the speaker, proven that case to me? What information have you put out there that really makes me feel that way? I mean, it seems to me I just see that over and over again as a pattern that needs to happen. But I'm curious how you would describe what it is that you think an audience needs to hear in order for them to feel like this was for me, this was for us, and yes, I can act on this, since that's what we're trying to do with the free note.
I try to get a lot of that from the meeting organizers, and the meeting organizers really can be your friends. And, you know, in this past year, I gave over 50 talks in the past year, and they were all about audio. I did everything on audio this year, which is, you know, it's kind of where my career has gotten to over the past couple of years in speaking. It wasn't always that way. But when I talk to a meeting organizer, if I'm speaking at like a general marketing conference, like Content Marketing World or Marketing Profs, then there's a level of assumed knowledge. And I'm still going to give the same kind of talk. And we talked about this last week. I give what now talks often, and the sort of triumvirate of why talks, what now talks, and how talks. I almost always give what now talks. But if I'm talking to an audience that has a level of assumed knowledge that is introductory, I'm going to give the same kind of talk, but I'm going to start with different kinds of information that I'm going to give them. I'm not going to assume that they have a depth of knowledge in what I'm talking about. And I get that from the meeting organizers. But I also, this past year, did a lot of keynotes, and they were free notes, but they were keynotes at very specific defined audio conferences and audio summits and podcasting things especially. And they're still what now talks, but I walk in knowing, both from the event organizers and also the people that are going, that they're already familiar with a lot of the basic research that we put out in these things. I'm talking to people that use it and sell it every day. So I have to do a different thing. Mm. My what now for them is a different what now than for the general marketing audience I'm talking to. I'm still giving a what now talk, but it's the level of assumed knowledge that is different. And I get that from primarily the meeting organizers.
Yeah. And I think it's critical when you are free noting to listen to the meeting professional, listen to the conference organizer when they tell you what it is that audience wants, because they are rarely wrong. And this is back to that, you're an expert in your stuff, but they're an expert in theirs. Like, they are an expert in what their attendees and their members, if it's an association, what they want. And your ability to come back is going to be very much dependent on your ability to deliver what that audience wants. And they're going to be looking at things like the evaluations and feedback they get from the audience about what it is that you do. So if you're going to try to like break it, break the expectation and be like, well, I know they said they really wanted a tactical talk, but I'm going to give them my keynote. You have to be really, really, and I mean really good. And I don't mean just like, you think you're better than average, like 85% of the population, you actually have to be great. And I think you have to warn them that you're actually going to do a different thing so that you reset that expectation in the moment.
So I discovered this great question a few years ago, and it worked it worked incredibly well. And it was actually a talk that you and I traveled to together. I gave a keynote for the Western Association of Broadcasters in Banff.
Oh, Banff!
Banff!
Banff! Banff! Banff! Banff! Banff!
And we had this great conversation. And actually, I talked to the media organizers probably at least three times before I went out and gave the talk. And it was curious to me why they wanted to talk to me so much. And on the one hand, I'm not going to give a talk that's not congruent with the data that I have and who I am. I'm not going to go up and be something I'm not, right? I'm not going to give a talk that is not congruent with who I am or flies in the face of the data that I have. There's not going to be this bizarro opposite Tom who gives a speech he normally wouldn't give.
Mott.
It's a nickname of mine in high school, by the way, you've just uncovered.
All right, all hackers, take note.
Yeah, right. Don't tell them that's my password. But the question that I asked the organizers, because they were clearly very inquisitive about exactly what I would talk about. I asked them this question, and it came to me on the fly, but it worked really well. What types of talks have failed there? Because they've been doing this meeting for decades.
That's a great question.
What kinds of talks have failed there? And they had a really good answer. And so all I had to do was not do that. Yeah. So once I knew that, I mean, oftentimes when you do research, it's not to tell you what to do. It's to give you the lane. Mm. And tell you what not to do. And if you know what not to do, then you can work that lane very creatively. And that ended up being a very productive question.
What did they tell you not to do?
Well, I mean, they were an audience of traditional broadcasters. And I think they have been inundated for years and years and years about how they don't get digital, they don't get this, they don't get that. Well, they actually do. They have existing infrastructures and architectures. And so they need to know, we can't just burn the furniture and walk away from all that. Like, how do we, not just how does anybody, how do we transition into that? And I think they've just had years and years of people going in saying, you're dumb, you're behind the times. They're not dumb. They're not behind the times. They have these existing businesses that they can't just walk away from. And so asking them that question gave me a whole new angle onto what it was I was going to talk about anyway, but it made me a lot smarter about it.
You just swung into one of my favorite topics, which is how you perceive the audience that you're talking to in the first place. And I think I think it's a critical thing to start from the assumption that these are smart, capable, and good people, that they already know a lot of things, and that whatever they're doing right now is because they are trying very, very hard to do a good job at whatever it is they're doing. And so when a meeting organizer like the one from Banff gives you an answer like that, I think it's critical that you listen to them, because they are telling you what that mindset is where they're starting. And if you want to be a great speaker, I don't care whether you're a freenoter or not, you have to start from where the audience is right now. And I don't think there's any better way than talking to the meeting organizer, or if you have that research, talking to your frontline people, your salespeople, your customer service people, about where are people right now? What do they think the problem is? What are their questions? What are their challenges? Because if you can start your talk from there, and that's why I say that's what I always will typically customize, is I will shift what question I'm starting from, then you're going to capture them, and you're going to have an opportunity to do what's known as radical empathy, which is describe their world so well that they understand that you understand it, and that you validate their feelings about it. So that, you know, the situation that you're talking about, you could have gone in there and were like, yeah, you're dumb, but you can also go in there from the perspective of, you guys are smart people. I know you know this is coming, but there's also real trouble in figuring out how do you make this work with these legacy systems systems and these legacy patterns that you have. I mean, I don't know if that's the angle that you took, I just think that that's your work as a speaker, is you have to figure out how to draw them, how to go back to where they are and make that connection to where you want them to be, not just expect them to jump where you are and think that they're stupid for not doing that.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think the difference between a speaker that is not really paying attention to where the audience actually is and one that does. And I'll go back to this, you know, Western Association of Broadcasters conference talk that I gave.
We can go back to Banff anytime.
We can go back to Banff anytime, by the way. No matter where you look, it's a postcard. Is that I think it's really easy to go in when you are a speaker that has seen a lot of things and talked to a lot of conferences.
I've seen so many things.
I've seen too much. And talk to an audience like this and say, here's something I bet you haven't thought of. But here's the thing. They're smart, capable, and good, as you say. They have thought of it. And every time a speaker, I think, goes into a conference like that and has the attitude, here's something I bet you haven't thought of, they need to be prepared that the audience is going to come back to them, either verbally or not, and say, we have thought of it. Here's something you haven't thought about. How does our specific industry do this thing?
Right.
Because you have not thought that through.
Yeah, it's back to, is it possible for me? Right? How is it possible for me? And again, that comes back to your work as a speaker, making sure you know that. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think, you know, if I'm working with clients on this, one of the first things that I will ask them once we kind of figure out what that audience question is, and then we start to talk about what's the real problem. One of the first questions I'll ask them after they've said they've identified it, I'm like, but would your audience already say they know that? And if they say yes, then I'm like, then that is not the problem. We're going to move that up to the goal, because why waste their time with, hey, you have this question and hey, you have this problem. I'm like, don't start right where they start, right at the pain point, start right where they know they have a problem. And then it's your job as a speaker or as a company to figure out, well, what's the perspective you're bringing there that's going to reveal something new. And so this is why I think just if, as long as you're always focusing on what are the questions that the audience is asking right now, you're always going to have a very simple and very effective way to customize your talk to an audience without having to redo the whole talk every time, because you should be able to just link it back up to your company's or your perspective on what's the real problem. Why is that such a problem? What should we do instead?
What a brilliant transition into this week's Real Hero of Speaking.
Real Hero of Speaking. Okay, no, we should never do.
And yet we did. You're welcome, audience. I mean, we've talked a lot about the feedback that you can get from meeting planners and meeting organizers. I think the ultimate is when you can get credible, representative feedback from the audience themselves. And that's something that Sally Hogshead
does
all the time, right?
So good. She is my personal hero of public speaking. So, you know this, but about 4 or 5 years ago, I really set as an intention. I said, I really want to be on those big stages. What do I need to do? And there are some folks that I looked to say, who are the folks that everybody respects and likes on stage? Like, who are those people that have that reputation? And of course, as a female speaker, I was curious as to who are those people. And there were two names that came up over and over again. One is Pamela Slim, and one was Sally Hogshead. And I'm happy to count them both as friends now. But Sally's just amazing, and she's not only amazing with how much of herself she brings to the stage, which I respect enormously, and the fact that she has done the work, which you and I both respect. But I love how she incorporates this amazing ability to kind of tap into what the audience wants most to know about, which is themselves, mm-hmm. as the way that she customizes her keynotes.
The one thing that really interests me about what Sally does, and as you say, she's done the work. She's done the work in the science of the way that people actually see themselves and the way that they express themselves.
And it's her message too, which is awesome. Yes.
Yeah. So she has a book called Fascinate, but she's also developed this whole personality assessment for how to fascinate. And there are all these different, sort of types of person that you are.
I'm a provocateur.
You're a provocateur.
I adore.
I'm a gourmand.
I don't think that that's one of them.
Oh, I'm a raconteur.
That I wouldn't be surprised. Again, I don't think it's one of her categories, but no, her assessments are great and A, on their own. But one of the things that she does that's so brilliant with how she uses them to customize the audience is that most often, I believe the way she does this is that she has the assessment bundled into her keynote so that she, in advance of her giving the keynote, delivers the assessment to all the people in the audience. And so this does a couple things for her. One, you know, the structure of the keynote stays fundamentally the same, but there's a couple key moments, and in a certain ways similar to what we were talking about the other week with Phil Jones. But what she does specifically is that she's able to talk about that audience against how the rest of all of her data proves out. Like, so she can say, well, this audience is particularly this way, and that is, you know, either left or right of center when she looks at everybody else. And then the other thing she does is that with those people's permission, she picks out a couple folks from the audience and then uses them as examples, you know, from the stage. I know that she does this because she did that with me one time. It was Social Fresh, and she was the keynote at Social Fresh. She will talk about that person, have them stand up and have a quick conversation with them from the stage. And it's just an extraordinary way to not only land her point, which is incredibly valid, but also make the audience feel like they are a part of it. Because there's lots of good science that shows that when an audience member from the group is brought up or spoken to, the audience aligns with that person, and the audience themselves feel like they have been brought up on stage or spoken to directly.
Yeah, and what I love about the fact that she starts with this assessment, you know, if I just walk in and I'm a marketing speaker or I'm a speaker about psychology, then you walk into the talk as an audience member thinking, all right, this is a talk about marketing. This is a talk about human resources. But when you have taken the assessment that she does before this talk, you walk in saying, all right, this is going to be a talk about me.
Mm.
You have that expectation.
Yeah.
And you're naturally going to pay more attention to that.
Yeah. And then what she does on the back end of the talk is that, you know, she often bundles in book signings and whatever. And then what she does on the back end is, gives one extra little piece of information that's kind of tailored to you and your type. And when she's signing the book, she just gives you a couple quick insights into your type. And it's just, I mean, it's so brilliant because, I mean, no doubt it's why she gets hired. I mean, she's a paid keynoter. We should make that really clear. But I think the lessons are particularly true that can be carried forward by a freenoter because honestly, your company probably has the resources to think through what an assessment like that could look like for your particular audience. And I mean, you've worked with a number of companies on building assessments like that.
Oh yeah. I mean, especially, you know, a data-driven assessment that's based on, you know, real world observational behaviors that you can quantify. And what this really does, I think, whether you're a paid keynoter or a freenoter, is provide you with research into the condition of the audience that you're dealing with, you know, the human condition of the audience that you're dealing with. It offers you the ability, I hope genuinely, to appear that you are diagnostic and not prescriptive, right? I hate people who prescribe without diagnosing, who come in and say, this is your problem. You need to do this. You need to follow these steps. It's really hard to sort of take umbrage with that when you as a group have filled out some kind of a diagnostic and that diagnostic has been applied in visible ways to the speech, to the keynote, to the free note, to the conversation, such that you see yourself in it and you see your company in it. And that's the power of an assessment, I think, for any corporate speaker, if you can come up with that kind of initial diagnostic that people are willing to take that allows you to characterize where they are and also characterize where they want to go.
Absolutely. I mean, well, you helped me come up with one that's on my site. I think it comes back to that kind of fundamental quality of freenotes that we're talking to, this balance and usefulness and utility to the speaker and the audience. Because when you can craft an assessment in a certain way where it gives you information, but also when it's crafted in such a way that it tells people what they need to do to close that gap without you. I mean, that's so powerful. Not only does it allow you to do what Sally does, which is truly customize that content to the audience, but it also gives them that extra gift of, I now have something I can do with this as a result. And that is such an enormously powerful way to honor your audience and to give to them, which is fundamentally, I think, what the heart of a great keynote and freenote is all about.
And this is gifting season.
It is. But first, I want to give a for the use of Umbridge.
Thank you very much. We are Websters.
We have all the words.
We have all the words. Yes. Yeah. It is gifting season.
It is. What'd you get me?
I got you this podcast.
Oh my gosh, it's the best.
You're welcome. And it's a season where people go to parties and
they do.
And they can overindulge.
They can.
So this week's pellet, the pellet of the week,
the Nilifer Merchant Honorary Pellet of the Week,
is a classic. It's a champagne cocktail.
So tell us about the champagne cocktail.
The champagne cocktail, originally, and you're soaking in it now, as we like to say, it was originally a way to sort of trick up not great sparkling wine.
Which I didn't know when I bought us the supplies for this, so I bought us Veuve Clicquot.
You did. You bought us Veuve Clicquot, and you are not going to go wrong doing that.
Well, I wanted to celebrate Neen James.
Yeah, Neen James, our champagne-loving dear friend.
Oh, and a great keynoter.
And a connoisseur of the bubbly.
Of the Widow Clicquot.
Of the Widow Clicquot, which is a great story.
It is.
So the champagne cocktail, originally made to dress up not the greatest sparkling wine, perhaps.
But it's extra good with the Veuve, I have to say.
It ain't bad. Is essentially, you take a champagne flute, you put a sugar cube in the bottom of it. We're using a Demerara sugar cube here. You soak that sugar cube with Angostura bitters.
But I'm not bitter.
Not yet. And you top it off with some kind of sparkling wine. And the more you get to the bottom of that drink, as you just did, the sweeter it gets. And also a lemon twist or some kind of citrus peel, very important in this. So citrus peel, a bitters-soaked sugar cube, topped up with champagne. And it's a delightful holiday drink.
It is. It becomes more delightful as you drink it. And I don't think that's just the product of the champagne. But yeah, the flavor changes as you drink
That's right.
Because it, you know, as the various things get released, but it's a beautifully well-balanced cocktail as well. I'm not as familiar with this. This is actually, I have to admit, my first champagne cocktail. But it's lovely.
And there's an even more adult kicked up version of it, by the way, which throws in an ounce of cognac.
Yes. Well, that's fancy.
It's very fancy, yeah.
So you can truly celebrate when you move up from free note to T&E note, maybe, by adding the cognac.
By adding the cognac. That is your present to yourself, to add the ounce of cognac.
The VSOP, very common answer in crosswords, just saying.
But it's a fantastic holiday cocktail.
It is.
Because it's really just champagne. But it allows you to say to someone, no, I'm having a champagne cocktail.
Well, it also has, but thanks to the Angostura, it has this kind of extra rosy, slightly red tone to it. So I think it's quite pleasant to look at as well.
Just like my wife.
See that coming? Smooth.
Right?
You're smooth.
I'm smooth. So as it is approaching the holiday season, we are going to take a short break.
We are.
We're going to take a 2-week hiatus.
2 weeks?
2 weeks.
What are they going to do?
I think they're going to be fine.
Oh, I hope so.
They're going to spend time with families.
As they should.
They're going to listen to all those other podcasts. That don't take a break.
That's just, yes.
Well, we're going to take a break because we have to take it. We're traveling.
We are.
We're vacationing. Vacation. All I ever wanted.
All I ever needed.
Have to get away. So we're going to do that. We'll be back on January 7th.
It's a good day.
It's a good day.
Lucky 7th.
And that's going to wrap up the Freenoter for 2019. When we return on January 7th, we're going to look at some of our favorite rituals that keep us sane and at the top of our game.
We'll mix up our Real Heroes of Speaking segment by each sharing a favorite book on the craft.
And now that the excesses of the holiday season are over, we get back to basics with the cocktail version of Leftovers, the Well Manhattan.
All that and more on the next episode of The Freenoter.
Cheers.
Cheers.